You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Sam.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter and head of the entire Non-Zero Media Empire, which also includes this podcast, the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Samuel Hammond. You are chief economist at the Foundation for American Innovation, which I guess means you get to boss around the legions of other economists at the Foundation for American
One and the only, still.
The one and only. Well, see, last time we talked, you were a senior economist at the Niskanen Center. I asked if there were any junior economists, and commendably, you told me the truth. No, you were the only economist. And now it turns out you're the chief, and there's no...
Yeah, it was a good fundraising year.
Okay. So anyway, but you still have an affiliation in Niskanen, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Or not? Good.
Okay. Non-resident, as they say.
Yeah, that's a common thing these days. So the last time you were here was right after the November election. At that point, you professed, I think, satisfaction that Trump had been elected. You had supported him. You thought, on balance, he was a better candidate, particularly in the areas you're most concerned about, digital technology policy, especially AI policy. That's all what we talked about. I may have occasion in the course of this conversation to ask you if he's done anything that have given you second thoughts about your support of him, but I won't start off that way. I want to do mainly two things here. I want to address two big policy areas. One is the tariffs. One is the AI. In both cases, try to figure out like what he's up to, which is a little more perplexing in the case of tariffs for a lot of people. And then try to figure out where things may be headed, which is of particular interest to most people, probably with the tariffs. So you had the distinction of being the first person I saw on Twitter to posit a theory of what theory might be motivating his tariff policy. Now, this is some time ago. Of course, it has evolved, as they say. It's been kind of a roller coaster ride, and there's no one theory of tariffs that I think could explain everything he's done.
Right.
More likely, there are different factions in the administration who hold different theories, plus he just loves headlines. So you put all that together and maybe you get what we've got. But why don't you start out by telling us the theory that I really hadn't heard, and it makes sense about this kind of, I guess, not mainstream view of what tariffs should do. But I think, and you still believe that this is operative somewhere in the administration?
Yes. You know, the part of this theory is that they're going to host some kind of Mar-a-Lago accord. I have no, you know, crystal ball. Really, what alerted me to this was watching, first of all, you know, knowing like folks like Orrin Cass and people in that world, big defenders of tariffs.
Who is Orrin Cass?
Orrin.
Oh, Orrin Cass.
Of American Compass, one of the champions of the tariffs. Right around the transition, seeing how someone like Lighthizer, who had been Trump's USTR representative in the first administration, was rejected for being too soft on trade policy. So that was one indicator. Around the time that Scott Bessent was being vetted for Treasury Secretary, he was going on podcasts saying how he has spent his whole life studying the Bretton Woods period and how he is excited to have a chance to do something similar.
Well, let's drill down on that a little, meaning something similarly dramatic in terms of restructuring the global economy. And maybe we should just stop and say, like, what your theory, like what this plan is for tariffs. And you brought it out at a point where I think it was starting to look like the tariffs were going to be so sweeping that we couldn't explain them as just Trump wanting to use them as bargaining chips to bargain these various nations down in terms of their tariffs. We needed another theory. And What is the plan, you think, maybe afoot still in some corners of the administration, even if it's not currently the operative plan?
So when the zeitgeist of the new right, there's a critique of the American dollar as the global reserve currency. The fact that most of the world trades in U.S. dollars appreciates the value of the dollar, makes our exports less competitive. It leads to financialization because people around the world rush to the U.S. dollar as a safe asset, and that pumps up our real estate and financial markets, and leads to this sort of consumerist economy where we live beyond our means but don't really build anything. And if we want to reindustrialize, that's sort of a force of economic gravity we're always fighting against. Now, and this also ties in with like fiscal sustainability and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's a very common view. J.D. Vance has articulated that view. Scott Bessent has articulated that view. Trump's CEA chair, a man named Stephen Miron, wrote a paper in November called A User's Guide to Restructuring the Global Monetary Order or something to that effect. And so, you know, the tariff, we all know Trump likes tariffs. We all know that he complains about the trade deficit. We all know that he, you know, tariff is his favorite four-letter word. But there's two ways that tariffs can be wielded. They could be wielded as a bilateral thing. We want to tariff a particular product. We want to tariff a particular country. Or as Stephen Miron suggested in his paper, they could be part of a broader strategy for resetting the global trading system overall and mm-hmm. and doing a rebalancing, as it were, to correct for the overinflated dollar. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge here and what makes it sort of this 4D chess type of thing is Trump likes the reserve currency. He doesn't want, when he hears about the BRICS countries creating an alternative monetary system, he says, no, you know, don't do that or else we'll sanction you. So they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want everyone to use the U.S. dollar, but they want the dollar to be weaker relative to our creditor countries that are producing everything. And okay. So this is sort of in the background.
Okay. So there are two issues here, and I'm wondering if they're separate issues. There is the fact that the dollar is strong or has been generally. I mean, and there's a fact that it is kind of at the center of the financial system. It was used as a standard medium of trade by many countries, even when the trades didn't involve us. Now, I gather those are related and maybe even correlated, but you could preserve the centrality of the dollar in the system and still pursue a weak dollar policy in the near term, I assume. But I gather what these people, which you say include Bessent, which kind of surprises me because I thought Wall Street was looking to him as the mainstream voice who would keep our tariff, you know, within policy within mainstream bounds. But anyway, you're saying this may include him. I gather they want both things. They want a weaker dollar, which should boost exports, and they want the dollar not to be central to the financial system. And does that have like a separate rationale, or is it just that they think the more central it is, the stronger the dollar is going to be, and they want a weak dollar?
They want both. So they want to keep it central, but they want to resolve mm-hmm. the paradox that by being central, it inflates the dollar. And so one way you could do that is by throwing massive tariffs on the world and then going one by one to countries that are ripping us off in Trump's terms, that are doing industrial policies that are otherwise, you know, have persistent surpluses against us, and cajoling those countries into buying our long-term debt. And so sort of locking in basically forcing those countries to appreciate against the U.S. dollar while still keeping the U.S. dollar as the global reserve.
So you mean that becomes part of the bargaining? We don't just want lower right. tariffs. We also want them to buy treasuries? Like that's a concession or something?
Yeah, so there's this idea floating around for, you know, 50 or 100 year century bonds. This goes back mm-hmm. to a critique mm-hmm. Trump had of Janet Yellen, that when interest rates were so low, you know, why didn't we lock those in for 100 years? Mm-hmm. Instead, we're rolling over 6 month, 3 month, 5 year mm-hmm. treasury debt. And you know, now we have interest rates rising, yields are going up, the you know, just servicing the cost of our debt is more than the whole entire defense budget. Now, if you forced a country to roll over their debt and buy like low yield long-term bonds, that's not that different from a default, a sovereign default. And that's where I worry this could be heading, that if you really want to make, you know, the US competitive from a currency exchange point of view, defaulting will do that because it will lead to everyone leaving.
It's proven, and we start to see hints of this.
Right. So all the market turmoil we've seen over the weekend from yields rising, the dollar falling, this is what capital flight looks like. This is foreign investors pulling their capital out of the US dollar because they're uncertain to what's going to happen next.
So to drill down on that, like the first surprise was when the interest rates on US treasuries rose rather than falling, because typically when you get an exodus from stocks, which was happening at that point, they go into bonds. And if more people buy bonds, the interest rates come down. That was a little weird. And then people pointed out what you just referred to is like the dollar. Like if you look over history for a long time, the fate of the dollar is tightly correlated with the fate of interest rates on treasuries. And suddenly there was a departure. Dollar's going down and treasury rates are going up. Is that started happening like last week?
Yeah.
Is that still happening today? The rates are going back down today, I think. Okay. Well, and that's weird, and that's not consistent with the plan. Of course, they didn't stick with the plan, first of all, we should say, right? I mean, let me sketch out a little more clearly than I did the first time some alternative theories. I mentioned, you know, tariffs could be bargaining chips. And then it could also be industrial policy where you want to reshore factories. But if that's it, you're generally kind of surgical about which industries you target, right? Because some kinds of factories are just not coming back. And so you want to focus on the kinds of factories that could, you know, with the least sacrifice on our part, so to speak, in terms of the price of that consumers pay for the tariffs, you know, can be brought back. Well, from the beginning, it wasn't. Well, okay, there was an auto tariff and there were steel tariffs. So there's a little of that. But then there was the across the board 10% tariff. And then, of course, there was a little special tariff for China, which Trump always does. But then there was these reciprocal tariffs, which you had to come up with yet another rationale for. And the truth is, I think if you look at the way they were calculated, there is no coherent rationale, right? Because it looks like they just made them proportional to the trade deficit with that specific country. And although there are lots of views about tariffs among economists, I would imagine you're pretty hard pressed to find an economist who thinks that your goal should be to balance trade with each country, right?
With like Madagascar.
That's flat out.
The Falkland Islands.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
That's where we are.
It does make some sense if your goal is to engineer a Nixon shock, right? The Nixon shock being when we moved off the gold standard in 1971, this was the end of Bretton Woods, the unraveling to the current world, the current regime, where countries have free-floating exchange rates. We control our monetary policy, but have free-floating exchange rates and open capital mobility. So capital can move around countries, currencies rise and fall, but the Federal Reserve and other central banks can control their monetary policy. That's the current regime. If we wanted to go back to a Bretton Woods regime, you would have to engineer a similar shock, something of that magnitude, to upset the apple cart. And because there's a huge network effect to the US dollar, you can't just ask people nicely. You have to really spook them. So, you know, I'm not saying there's method to this madness, because I totally agree that the messaging, the communication has been abysmal. I don't know if after the Signal group chat debacle that they had like a ban on having
on communication among administration officials.
Yeah, or something, because it's just been all over the place. And then Trump himself is like this X factor where I don't think he understands any of this. And he really just does have this, like, it's not even mercantilist. I don't think even the old school mercantilists were this remedial in their understanding of trade deficits. Like it is a kind of, you know, you're watching Lou Dobbs at 3 a.m. in a kind of stupor approach to trade policy. But so he gets presented with these options, and the Washington Post reported on this 3 hours before his speech, this Liberation Day speech. They hadn't even chosen the tariff schedule yet.
Yeah.
And then he was given this menu. He picked the one that was biggest. And then everyone was shocked. Like, and no one, you know, pushed back at all. So that makes it even harder to interpret.
And it seems like, So then there have been, so he got to that point with the reciprocal tariffs where there were all these things going on and just the mountainous tariffs collectively that economists were warning were going to drive us into recession. And apparently, you know, as you suggested, one pivotal moment was when he was watching TV. It was Maria, what's her name show? And I guess Jamie Dimon was on it saying that this could be bad. And Trump said, yeah, that kind of makes sense to me. It could be bad. So I changed it so it would be good, you know? And so he suspends the reciprocal tariffs, these huge tariffs on a bunch of countries that varied. And then he exempted, meanwhile, he was bidding up the tariffs with China. Because if he figured, like, if he said to China, like, publicly, if you don't back down, I'm going to put another 50% of tariffs on you. Trump figured, well, sure, that's a good way to get him to back down, is to make it so they have to humiliate themselves in public. That's a great idea. So, of course, so now the tariffs with China, they're just so high that's like, in principle, trade, I guess, basically grinds to a halt, except his latest innovation is to exempt what amounts to, I think, about a fourth of the imports from China, these electronic goods like smartphones.
Right, which may be a kind of another false flag because they then turned around and said, no, they're not exempt. Right. We're just doing sector-specific tariffs because these are not on the negotiating table.
So do you account, before you, if you're willing to guess where things are headed for now, from here, do you agree that it seems like the shifts in these tariffs have less to do with like competition among the coalitions in the, you know, the factions in the administration who have the different worldviews and their success in convincing them? Although maybe there's implicitly a little of that, but it seems like it has less to do with that than with Trump just freaking out at various points and getting freaked out by the stock market and stuff like that. I mean, it's basically just him shifting moods, kind of.
I mean, he said on a press conference, I just go off instinct. Right. and also the last person who spoke with him. So I think, you know, the reason they paused the tariffs was because the bond market was going crazy. It looked like almost like a run on the bank where the bank is the US dollar. And Bessent, you know, showed him the chart and said, sir, we need to pause this now.
Yeah. And of course, increased treasury rates mean that just the cost of running the government rise, right? Because we're borrowing so much money.
This is the doomsday scenario, the worst scenario. Like, there's a good scenario, or, you know, least bad scenario, where all this uncertainty and disruption leads to a kind of mild recession. You know, we're all a little bit poorer, a little bit less productive, but life goes on. Mm-hmm. There's another scenario where things kind of escalate, whether because of further trade actions or because the market continues to freak out. And then the administration responds by, for instance, imposing capital controls and says, okay, you're trying to get your dollars out of the U.S., you're not allowed. Mm-hmm. And it's those kind of situations. It's similar to like when you have a bank run and suddenly they put a limit on how much you can withdraw. that's the sign that the bank run's really starting, and then everyone goes to the mm-hmm. ATM.
Nothing inspires confidence like telling people they can't take the money that is theirs. So what, first of all, how much, I mean, you would think that we are in a much less dire situation than we were at the height of the tariffs, which did seem likely to just lead to untold amounts of turbulence and inflation and stagflation and so on. You'd think we're a lot better off now that he's suspended a lot of tariffs. There is still the universal 10% on all nations, I think.
Yeah,
I guess is the auto thing still in effect, 25%? Although, mm-hmm. although he kind of partly exempted some Canadian and Mexican imports to some extent. You'd think we're in significantly better shape, but what's your read of like where we are and how worried we should be?
So the pause caused the markets to rally, but then I think there was a reflection on how large the tariffs still are, and yes, we're not with this full reciprocal program, but China is our largest trading partner. They're half of the trade deficit. Mm-hmm. 125%, 145, whatever it is today, is a lot. I saw Brad Setzer estimate that it's equivalent to a $90 a barrel increase, $90 increase in a barrel of oil, right? So like that's massive. That's just the China portion. So the markets are now realizing and starting to like figure this out that, you know, we've went from basically an effective 25% tariff, like overall, and now we're down to like an 18%, right? So like, these are still the highest tariffs we've ever had in 100 years. And 100 years ago, we weren't nearly so import dependent.
So in other words, like a couple of weeks ago or whatever, whenever it was at the height, the average tariff, that the hike on the average import was, what did you say? It was
about 25%.
25. And now it's down to what? To
like 18%.
So 18. And about half of that generally falls on consumers. Is that right? So that would be like a...
No, like most 90? Estimates, it's like the pass-through is closer to 90%. So
really?
It almost... Yeah.
Great.
The retail is a little bit lower, but the overall is closer to 90.
So 15%, say, on consumer, de facto consumer tax on imports. And then what percentage of the products Americans buy are imports, roughly?
I don't have the number off the top of my head. I think it's like 18%, something like that.
Okay, so it's kind of maybe a de facto 3% sales tax on every product you buy on average, something like that.
The Yale Budget Lab put out estimates that this is going to cost just the updated, you know, post pause, just the updated tariffs will cost the average American $4,400 a year.
That would be inflationary. So now you know people that I don't know, and I know people you don't know, but the people you know are important and they have connections to this administration. Do you have any sense for where this is headed from here? Or is that a pointless question when you've got a guy who just wakes up every morning and goes, I'm feeling lucky, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, in the Biden administration, I knew some principals, but then I also would know people at the Department of Commerce, or I know people at different agencies. And this time around, I do know some people at different agencies, but it's pointless to ask them for their take because this is being made up on the fly in the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm. So what about this, the surprise I expressed that the Treasury Secretary, Bessent, is turns out to be a radical on tariffs? Like apparently he is a supporter of this weird idea of using tariffs to both weaken the dollar and through negotiation or something, coerce countries into buying a bunch of treasuries. So that, I guess the point being, so we could have a low dollar and low interest rates, or I still don't.
Right.
That's the goal. And that would ordinarily be hard, but they thought they had a way to do it.
So he said explicitly on several podcasts that he went in the All In podcast and they were like praising his, you know, strategic acumen, that, you know, the first thing they want to do is lower the treasury yield so they could roll over the debt and save money. You know, that backfired. Yields are now a lot higher. Bessent is not a tariff maximalist. That was Peter Navarro, or Peter Ricciardo, right, as Elon called him.
Elon is nothing if not witty, I'll tell you.
He's a wordsmith. What Bessent has referenced is doing a new Bretton Woods, by which he means, at least seems to mean, returning to some kind of global managed trading system that is pegged to gold or pegged to some other commodity. So, and this isn't an uncommon view. It's sort of this kind of neo-Austrian view you hear around like hedge fund guys and Wall Street, mm-hmm, that it's not really... a lot of the supply siders think this way. That doesn't really fall out from any standard macroeconomic theory, but this idea that, you know, ever since we went off gold, we've been playing with funny money and we need to get back on the real hard stuff. And Bessent, the day or two after the tariffs, went on Tucker Carlson's show and said, you know, before I joined the Treasury, people would consider me a gold bug. So I worry that, you know, that's like the real rug pull. Because that's essentially saying, you know, once we redenominate the dollar onto gold or some other, maybe a Bitcoin, who knows what the hell to
do. I wondered about that.
That's going to be incredibly chaotic. And like that's, there's a reason we got off gold, right? It caused the Great Depression.
Because there was so much rigidity in exchange rates among countries, so they couldn't adjust to reflect structural changes of various.
Well, that was the end of Bretton Woods. But before that, in the 30s, you know, the Great Depression was because when you peg your dollar to a commodity like gold and people start hoarding gold, which is happening right now, you know, gold is up. Then you can have a deflationary spiral and, 30% unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of how the politics of this will play out and the economics, I mean, I assume the administration is trying to negotiate some deals with countries where, first of all, it can show that, look, with this country at least, tariffs are lower than they were when I came into office, right? They'd like to be able to point to some examples of that. So tariffs are lower than the status quo ante, right? The tariffs we face, certainly. He wants to show that he has bargained them down. He's less intent on our dropping our tariffs, but presumably, and I guess he figures that we won't have to lower our tariffs below what they were before because countries face the prospect of his reinstituting the new but suspended tariffs. So that's probably his goal.
So right? If this was all just about like a short run negotiating tactic and like in 6 months, there will be no more tariffs because we'll have, we'll have strong armed Vietnam into reducing their tariffs. If that were the case, then that would already be happening because Vietnam came out and said, we're going to cut our tariffs to zero.
Uh-huh.
And they said that's not good enough. So it continues to raise the question.
They want below zero. They want Vietnam to pay us to buy their goods.
And it is true that there are these non-tariff trade barriers, but they're not all what they seem to be. So, like in some cases, maybe we have a drug that's approved in the U.S. but not approved in Europe because of our different drug regulations. That's a non-tariff barrier. But the reason Ford F-150s can't drive on Japanese roads is because Japan has thinner roads that, have rules about the weight of the vehicles so that they can not do so much road upkeep. Mm-hmm. Technically, that blocks our cars, but like that's their choice. They want to have less damage on the roads.
Yeah, well, so you're not optimistic, it sounds like, about getting a lot of tariff reduction out of bargaining. I wouldn't put too much stock in the fact that nothing's happened yet because, this administration is just not known for its smooth operation. I mean, this is like all of a sudden you got God knows how many countries you should, in theory, be negotiating with.
What I'm saying is they could have had a win. Like they could have said, Vietnam, your tariff is now back to the baseline 10% because you were willing to come forward immediately and negotiate with us. And that would send a signal. Everyone else should come and negotiate with us. But instead, they said, no, this isn't about your tariff rate. It's about something, vague and nondescript that we're not going to tell you. Some secret third thing.
Well, I predict they will come up with at least some examples of seemingly successful negotiation where, yes, they dropped their tariffs. And maybe they'll even revisit the Vietnam case. Then the other thing, they'd of course like to be able to do that with China, but it's hard for me to imagine, given the politics of the situation, Beijing being seen to have succumbed to the pressure, right? And giving us a better situation than the status quo ante. Doesn't that seem kind of unlikely to you? And that's what Trump wants.
Yeah. So Bessent, in his past interviews, seems to have a very naive view of China as like this communist centrally planned economy that is sort of teetering on the brink of collapse and we just need to push them and the house of cards will fall apart, not realizing that in some ways China is like more capitalist than America. Like they are very they do have like industrial policies and so on and so forth, but they're not this like top-down centrally planned economy, and they're quite robust. They have total control over their financial flows in a way that we don't. They have the ability to marshal huge resources to prop up industries. It is true that because they're a surplus country, they're much more trade dependent. And so this is putting a lot of significant pressure on them. but you know, they did zero COVID. They've done these like radical things in the past that show that they can tolerate a lot of pain. So I think it's a really risky game of chicken.
And the more of a jerk Trump is, the more solidarity there is, you know, behind the policies of the government, you know, I mean,
right.
China has.
And we've seen that everywhere. We've seen this rally around the rally around the flag in every country. Yeah.
Sure. No, I kind of suspect that Xi Jinping a week or two ago just thought, okay, you want to have a true showdown and just see whose society is stronger, which society can withstand a true battle. Our society is stronger than yours. And he's right. And it isn't. And it isn't. I think he's right. I mean, look at our society. Our institutions are crumbling. We're deeply divided in a way that China isn't. We've got a total clown in the White House. You know, we cannot get nations to trust that there will be any consistency anymore among administrations, right? Like nobody, increasingly, no country will take our word for a deal that's supposed to last beyond the end of a given administration.
Right.
And so, you know, it's, you know, and some people say, well, yeah, they're stronger because they're authoritarian, but I honestly don't think that is the bulk of the strength that they possess in a showdown with us. And
this would point out the other theory, which is that this is intentional sabotage, that this is similar to like
of which country?
Of America, of American empire and our ability to wield empire. Similar to like the deletion of USAID, right? You know, you could imagine like they could have repurposed USAID to, you know, get rid of the drag queen story hour and bring in, you know, Christendom as a foundation of Western civilization studies. Mm-hmm. They could have did something like that. Instead, they deleted it because they're trying to erode American soft power. And one of the big critiques of the US dollar has been, you know, not, yes, it lets us sort of live beyond our means, but also finances global hegemony. And we use it for sanctions and everything else. And so if you really want to like, and there's Austrian economists who make this argument explicitly. A guy named Josh Henderson wrote a paper on using tariffs to move towards off the treasury standard onto a gold standard, where one of his arguments was, if we need to do this because if we get back on gold, we can't fund wars in Afghanistan or wherever.
Yeah. Is that taken very seriously? I mean, look, parts of what Trump has done are a much milder version of that. The alienation of Western Europe is kind of part of a plan in a certain sense that, you know, he wants to shock them into realizing they're on their own. We're not going to be imperial in Europe, you know, as right. Trump would see it. And we're not going to be part of their war on Russia and so on. But this is like this would be 5D chess if the goal is to completely so thoroughly undermine America's economic and social health as to render it incapable of exerting force beyond its borders. That's one way to get rid of empire.
I mean, Marco Rubio said as much, where this is a pivot to multipolarity. You know, they clearly are trying to decouple from China and quickly, but not, it's in some ways, that's the alternative to projecting American primacy over the South Pacific. You know, it's saying you have your hemisphere, we have ours. Mm-hmm. No, we won't do a full de-dollarization, but we're going to basically have a much more fragmented international trading system.
But on balance, the best bet is there is no true coherence behind what is actually happening.
That's probably right.
Right. It's just Trump having some instincts. And so it's like, so how optimistic or pessimistic are you about the next year or two of let's just think about the economic health of the U.S. for starters.
I'm still long in the stock market because I think we're still the healthiest economy in the world right now. And, you know, in spite of all these things, you know, over the last 12 months, the S&P is still up. It's, mm-hmm. it's the question of these tail risks. And if things really escalate, things could go south really quickly. because financial crises happen slowly, then all at once. And so, mm-hmm. and then the question is, how do you hedge against that? Right. You know, like you said, normally you move from stocks into bonds, but bonds are also taking a beating. So, you know, I'm not going to put my money in the Canadian dollar either. So this is why people are buying gold. And it's, in some ways, this whole thing seems engineered to make, you know, to make the conservative talk radio host to tell you to buy gold coins seem like they're geniuses.
That's a good thing. I prefer that theory. Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon is behind this. Okay. So the China thing, the idea of, you know, disengaging, delinking from China is maybe one transition to the AI subject. I think you and I disagree here. Maybe we don't at the highest level of abstraction. I mean, I personally think if we go through the whole AI revolution on deeply adversarial terms with China, as currently seems fairly probable, that significantly increases the chances that the AI revolution will bring catastrophe to the world.
Agree.
You agree?
I agree.
Okay. And yet, you do favor one thing that is deepening the adversarial dynamic, which is the chip restrictions on China. And in fact, I saw on Twitter, I think I saw you were upset that China, so Jensen, is it Wang or Wong? How does he pronounce it?
Wong.
Wong of NVIDIA. I mean, I guess he paid $1 million for a dinner at Mar-a-Lago, as a number of other people did. And God knows what else he did while he was there. But after that, Trump, he didn't change the policy. What he didn't do is alter the policy in a way people he thought he was going to. There's this category of chips that had been exempt from the restrictions. We get into that. And we thought Trump was going to crack down on that, but he didn't. These are NVIDIA chips, the H20s.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were not happy about that. You want the restrictions to be tighter.
Yeah, I think that especially if you have short timelines to very powerful forms of AI, if demand is basically saturated, right, every one of these chips NVIDIA is going to sell to somebody, then we should try to have as many of them be in the West as possible. Not that we want to dominate China, but the install base of these data centers over time will be the thing that drives transformative economic growth. And so we should try to keep as many as possible. And China will be using them for surveillance, for offensive weapons. And so it just behooves us to try to, you know, keep a lead. And we can use that lead to reduce the risk of a hot conflict. And so, you know, one of my like EA cases for Trump, that piece I wrote back in August, was like, you know, part of the subtext there was
EA,
like Trump,
EA being effective altruism.
Right. Which I'm not.
You're not an EA guy, but every once in a while you make an EI case.
It was partly a reductio of like, you know, utilitarian arguments. It's like, you know, you can be led into funny conclusions if you are really utilitarian. I'm not truly utilitarian, but I think there is, for these really big catastrophic risks, there's no other way to think about things except in utilitarian terms. And, you know, there is a world where, you know, I kind of agree with you that Biden and Harris and the broader foreign policy blob were, gung-ho on escalating with China and asserting American primacy over Asia. Mm-hmm. And Trump, in spite of these tariffs and everything else, does the more realist faction in the Republican Party is more interested in power sharing and having more sort of realistic ambitions about the way we can project power. And Trump himself wants to like broker deals. He mm-hmm. respects Xi Jinping. And so, you know, if AI does kill us all, I don't think it's going to come from a rogue AI. It will come from great powers applying AI against each other and the killer drones descending on cities across America. And so I want to avoid that outcome. And yeah. I still think we're in a better world in this timeline. That seems a little bit less likely than in a Harris administration. That being said, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to retain our technological advantage. And China is happy to export control their technology. Mm-hmm. You know, and in some ways, you know, they're much less escalatory than these tariffs are. it's not that different in kind than, you know, the fact that we don't allow Iran or Russia to buy ICBMs. And if you think that this technology has the potential to be dual use, we should apply a similar standard.
Okay, I have devastating pushback for all this. However, we've come to the part of the show where we go into overtime, and the rest is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero Newsletter. There's a link in the show notes, and you get a lot of other content. You can set up your special members feed that'll always have the overtime parts of the conversations. But I want to get into a lot of AI stuff. I mean, there was, you saw this 2027 report, that this kind of futuristic narrative that came out, yep, got a ton of attention. I want to talk about that, about the sheer amount of progress, it seems to me, since there's been since our last conversation. I still am not sure that enough people grasp how fast things are moving. And I think you and I agree on that. And, you know, I had Dan Hendricks on to discuss that paper he did with Eric Schmidt and Alexander
Wang.
Wong or Wang. That's another pronunciation question. But
Wang, for sure.
Yeah. And I think that it wasn't intended to do this, but I think that their argument illustrates the folly of these aggressive chip restrictions. But anyway, that's the case I'll make. Before we go into overtime, anything else you want to say, things you want to, that you've done, that you want to draw attention to? Your Twitter handle is Ham and Cheese. When you think about it, folks, it's a very sophisticated kind of play on words, because his last name is Hammond.
I guess the biggest thing is that FAI, where I work, Foundation for American Innovation, we just launched a fellowship for conservatives interested in learning AI policy. So it's fai.org/fellowships.
Mm. I like that in principle, but I worry about what you're teaching them. Could I teach a seminar? I would like to.
Yeah, I'm working on the speaker list right now. If you want to come talk about,
where would I have to go?
You're working on a book yourself, right?
Yeah. Where would I have to go? Would I have to, like, DC? We can talk about this. Will you fly me business class? From New Jersey to DC.
From New Jersey. There's an Amtrak right down the road.
Well, there is Amtrak business class. Okay, we'll negotiate over that. Okay. Thanks everybody who's followed this far. Please join us in overtime. And we'll see you next time if you don't.